What I would offer is that this is an opportunity for us to look at how do we center the needs of people who use drugs, how do we listen to them, and create resources that are anchored in that.
Cassandra Frederick, Executive Director of Drug Policy Alliance, thank you so much. And Juan and I hope you'll join us tonight for the virtual celebration marking Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary at 8 p.m. Eastern Time at democracynow.org. We'll be speaking with Noam Chomsky, Angela Davis, Martina Spada, Winona LaDuke, Arundhati Roy, Danny Glover, Danny DeVito, and more. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook. It's just about 6 p.m. Time for another edition of Off the Wall. Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Believe you me.
Yeah, and here we are on a Tuesday evening. Guess what? We were supposed to have a 15-minute show this week. That was changed. The starting time of the basketball game was supposed to be at 6:15. It was changed to 6:55 because Starnivik was going to get some national coverage, I think, on SNY, Sports Channel, or whatever it's called. So they will do that. They'll move the start time of the game if you get national. You know, we can't do that. We can't say, oh, by the way, Kyle and Emmanuel want their show to go to 7 o'clock, so can you start the game a little later? No, but SNY, you can do that. But it was all for naught because apparently there's a COVID issue, and now the whole game has been canceled. So guess what, folks? You're stuck with us till 7.
How'd that win is still a mystery. Uh-huh. Just a little sparse on details.
I'm as disappointed as everybody else.
A player or the audience, who knows, maybe some other person in the building. We don't know what happened.
We don't know what happened. We don't. We just know it was COVID-related. We're blaming COVID, and nobody wins. So we're on until 7. I do know Finn is not here tonight because we told him not to come in, so he believed us and did not show up. So, 7 o'clock. It's going to be a mystery. So we'll see what happens then. But right now, it's us until 7, and this kind of thing happens. This kind of thing it's been happening. I'm sick of it. We're all sick of it. But yeah, we have to conquer it. We have to get past it. This Omicron variant. Hopefully, it's not as bad as we fear. The important thing is to be prepared for something that is bad and to take the necessary action. Because imagine if it is as bad as worst case scenario, you have something that spreads so much easier, you know, and is all over the place because it's spreading like crazy. You know, last year at this time, I don't think it was last week at this time, it wasn't even in this country. And now we had a case in Suffolk County. Yeah, we were one of the, I don't mean to sound proud, but we were one of the first states to have Omicron variant at all, and Suffolk County was one of those cases in New York. And now, of course, I think it's in half the states, and probably by next week it'll be in all the states.
Assuming you've taken it seriously and you understand and believe what's been widely agreed upon about it, it begs the question to hear this, when it does happen again and it is serious, will it be taken seriously then? And that's, I think, what you're speaking to, is that, well, this could be insignificant, but it's a test how quickly we can just take simple precautions
right
in the meantime until there is more information. That's kind of what we were saying, because it was hard to even report on.
Intelligent people, I think, will take it seriously. Idiotic people will mock it, will try everything possible to get around it and think they're proving something. I'm really sick of it. I'm really sick of it. I hear it everywhere. I hear it on our own airwaves. I hear it on all the other radio stations as well. People who don't take it seriously and I think it's some kind of a political issue when it's not. It's a health issue. And if you don't take it seriously, I guarantee if you listen to somebody, whether it's on this station or on any other station, who says it's not so bad, it's something that Joe Biden and Anthony Fauci are plotting something and somehow getting the whole rest of the world to participate, guarantee you they either have COVID now or have had it, and did not take precautions, have infected God knows how many other people, and I'm sorry, are idiots. You're an idiot if you don't take this seriously. It has to be something that we get past, and the only way to get past it is to either take a vaccine or somehow eradicate the virus in whatever means are possible. And right now we're still fighting it. Right now we're seeing numbers going up again. Yeah, it's not as bad as last year because we have a vaccine, and that's why many of us are able to to go out and enjoy life to a degree, at least, not as much as we want. I mean, I'm super upset that it's hard to find food in New York City after midnight. You know, the 24-hour places aren't 24 hours anymore. Oh, sure, we've got bodegas and things like that, but you know what I mean. It's not the same. And I want that back. Why would I support something that doesn't have that particular mainstay of life? It's the same everywhere. And, you know, obviously it's not just in this country, it's all over the world, and there are idiots all over the world who think it's some kind of a plot or conspiracy. If it is, it's the best conspiracy ever because so many medical professionals and scientists are on board. What exactly is the end goal here, to get people to stay inside? I mean, I don't know how that is in any way a goal that people would start a mass conspiracy. When was the last mass conspiracy that nobody leaked any information, that everybody, you know, stuck to the party line? Apparently we're part of the conspiracy too, and we don't even know what we're supposed to be doing, you know, as far as the conspiracy. As far as health, yeah, it's pretty obvious, it's pretty simple. But we're apparently part of a big conspiracy now to, what is it that we're supposed to be doing? Ending freedom? Injecting people with 5G? What is it again?
I don't know. We stopped getting faxes from the headquarters, so.
Maybe we're on the other side now, and there, I don't know. It's just, people, please, get the damn vaccine, get your booster shot, stay healthy. Be safe. You don't have to live your life in fear. Hey, we're not doing that. We went to a wedding over the weekend. You know, it's possible to go out and do things if you take precautions. We were asked, hey, show us your vaccination card or the thing that says on your phone that you got vaccinated. That's it. That's too much for you to do. That's too much for somebody to go out and show that information. Yeah, okay, they saw my name. Big deal. They would see my name. And any number of circumstances otherwise, it's nothing to freak out over. The things that you can freak out over, though, in my opinion, it's when it becomes mandatory to scan information about you and your whereabouts can be tracked. It's when people are being sent to prison or fined for not getting the vaccine. I think that's going way too far. But I think what New York City is doing is great. It's about time. Yeah, you can't get access to these places where the public goes if you're not vaccinated. So, yeah, you don't have to get vaccinated, but we don't have to let you in. And it's as simple as that. That's where we should be, and that's how you defeat this thing.
Yeah, even at that event, it was simple to make choices that did not exacerbate, you know, have outdoor activity and limit exposure to a lot of people in close quarters and so forth. So
right.
It is possible. But yeah, there's also that flip side. There are so many little things that are still missing. We're picking up the pieces of what has been lost in the aftermath of this historic health event. And I think all the things you said are wise. Please just, I would add, talk to your doctor, talk to your own doctor. How healthy are you mentally, physically? Like, if you're isolating yourself believing all kinds of things that are really, in large part, in the minority now, I don't know what else to tell you. I think that it can manifest in other really unhealthy ways and behaviors. So this is about personal edification and, you know, care. And we've all been through a lot with as many restrictions as there have been. We don't want to have continuation and much more, but it takes a lot of cooperation to be able to cope and move forward together.
You know, it's funny you say the minority, because it is a small minority of people that are basically sabotaging the whole effort to fight the virus. But they seem like the majority. And we see this so many times in our daily lives. You know, the last time the Republicans represented the majority in the Senate, represented the majority of individual people, the last time Republicans represented the majority in the Senate was last century, in the 1990s sometime. Yeah. It doesn't matter, though, because you only get two seats per state, so even though, two Republicans in a sparsely populated state are equal to two Democrats in a heavily populated state, it doesn't matter that the Democratic senators represent so many more people. The Republicans have equal, even more say. It's, you know, in this country, we vote by land, not by individual. It's sickening. With gerrymandering and with electoral college, there are so many methods that the minority view can be dominant. And now with the Supreme Court pretty much being stacked with conservatives, Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter even that you have the majority in office, because they can just snap their fingers and turn us back decades. And who knows how long that's going to last. And if you try to fix it, you get accused of the very thing that you're trying to fix. You know, if you try to balance out the Supreme Court, which is now stacked with conservatives, guess what you get accused of? You get accused of stacking the Supreme Court because you're trying to influence it. You know, I think you should be accused of trying to fix it because it's way broken. And, you know, these Roe versus Wade arguments that I've been hearing, Mississippi, Texas, it's all coming before the Supreme Court now. Next year, sometime probably in the summertime, they're going to be making a ruling that could basically unplug Roe versus Wade. Even though, in the confirmation hearings of the last couple of justices, they said, no, we're not going to touch that. It's precedent. It's established law. They lied. You know they lied. You knew they were lying back then. They're going to do exactly that. I will be shocked if they do anything otherwise. And, you know, this should emphasize so strongly to anyone out there that voting matters. And, yeah, you know what? We're all frustrated right now because Democrats can't seem to get anything done. Now, why is that? It's not because Democrats don't want to get something done. It's because the way the system is set up right now, they can't. The filibuster prevents the Senate from actually doing anything without Republican support. And the fact that there are at least two Democratic senators that are idiots, I'm sorry, I can't think of a better way to say it, that are basically, they're not team players, is that a better way to say it? That makes it really, really difficult and impossible. The solution is not to throw up your hands in despair and say, okay, that's it, I'm not going to vote again, or I'm not going to vote for Democrats because they never get anything done. No, you have to vote for more of them so that those idiots that stand in the way don't mean as much. So if you had, say, 60 Democratic senators instead of 50, which is debatable, then it wouldn't matter if two of them acted this way. You know, that's what we have to do. I keep hearing how Democrats are going to lose everything. They're going to lose next year. They're going to lose in 2024. I never hear the counter prediction of Democrats are going to gain because Republicans are being idiotic and obstructionist, standing in the way of infrastructure, standing in the way of social justice, trying to bring us back into the 1950s and maybe the 1850s. You know, with that kind of mentality, going against the grain of what society actually wants, because I think it's about a quarter of the people want Roe versus Wade overturned, but all the Republicans want this. Yeah, you know, how could they win? How could they possibly win? And yet, all the predictions say, yeah, they're going to win. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We need to start controlling the dialogue a little better, you know, and not just reacting to the things that Republicans say or that conservative commentators say. Reality is what you make it, you know?
Wow. I have so many different responses there that...
This podium made a difference. I don't know. Thank you for getting the podium.
How did you get up there while you were talking?
Well, I mean, you set it up. I think the steps are unnecessary, but that's why there's a pause after I finish the speech.
I'm glad I moved that scaffold.
But it makes you feel like you're really, you know, saying something that matters. And the cutout in the audience, that's a special touch. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, I painted a smile on that one over there, if you see. But contrarian, yeah, uncooperative within the party, I think, and I just the discussions, yeah, the dialogue and cooperation that it takes. It's not the greatest system. It's a messy system, and people have that frustration you'd spoken to in so many different ways when they can't even get to the politics and representatives and where they actually stand, what they need, how they can participate and what they need in their community and what translates to what. It's a lot. It's so much to ask of people to participate in, but it is what we have. And I don't know. I always think to myself, take an interest, one and all. And, I mean that. It's what we have. It's the system we have. Learn it, explore it, and do as much as whomever you think is contrarian to your initiative. Go get it. It's there for you. This is what we make it, as you said.
Never accept being defeated or being told that you're powerless, because you're not. All it takes is one voice standing up and saying no, or just phrasing things in a different way, or just standing against oppression or fanaticism of one sort or another.
Recharacterizing, I think that's good. Yeah, like saying in a different way. I think there's so many conversations that have become recycling old conversations and can get very unproductive. Mm-hmm. We need fresh ways of thinking about all of this, because there's so much. It's ridiculous. Just from speaking about public health and then how that has become politicized, and it's a fervor and a frenzy of things that need to be addressed and aired.
And we can't be afraid to make proclamations that some might disagree with. For instance, you just mentioned health care. You know, we have health care now. We have Obamacare. It's better than it was. People won't say that because it's not as good as they want it to be. And then Republicans move in and say, yeah, it should be dismantled completely because it's terrible and it's an overreach. No, it's not. It's better. We are in better shape now with Obamacare than we were without it. Period. That is my proclamation. That is my statement. I think if more people say things like that, then, okay, we can agree that we are in better shape. What's next? How do we make it even better? Rather than just, you know, kind of keep quiet, and then the only voices out there are those people saying it needs to be dismantled. That's what happens. That's what seems to always happen. We have made strides. We are moving in a forward direction. Even with Trump, even with 4 years of Trump, we made some really big steps in positive directions.
Part of that is well-made legislation, stuff that has been looked at, stuff that has been really researched and thought through, thoughtful politics, stuff where people got other opinions but didn't have, you know, stuff that was dug in and, mm-hmm. and unproductive.
I think it's mostly people power, though. It's mostly us. You know,
asking for what is absolutely needed.
It's not all politics. You know, just because somebody is in a particular office doesn't mean they have all the power. In the end, the power always belongs to the people. And it's just a question of, are they united, and do they have a cogent message, and do they know how to enforce that message? Now, right now, you know, I have to say, in this country on the left, very bad job of that, because most of it is spent fighting with each other, rather than uniting and moving in a particular direction stronger. Whereas Republicans, they're very good at uniting even when it's completely crazy and berserk. I mean, just look at where we are now with all the conspiracy theories about the virus, the vaccine, elections, you name it. And yet somehow they haven't fallen apart. Somehow they've managed to stick together and even become stronger in the craziness. You know, and the rest of us just kind of standing on the sidelines saying, did you see that? That's, whoa, what's going on here? But they keep winning. They keep taking power. And it's scary. You know, we talked about the Proud Boys marching in various villages throughout Long Island, comparing that to the early days of the Nazis. And it's, you know, it's very similar. I've been pointing this out in various social media areas, for what that's worth. You know, to be corrected and told, you know, they didn't murder all these Jews. Yeah, because, you know, the Nazis in the early 30s also didn't do that yet. But the signs were there, if you care to look at them. And when you see jackbooted thugs marching down streets, holding flags, and basically intimidating the hell out of everybody, and they keep growing in numbers, that's something you damn well better be concerned about. Okay? Don't tell me what they have and haven't done. This is what they stand for. Look at what they are doing. Look at what they are saying. Look at history. And this past week, there was another demonstration right at the Lincoln Memorial. There were hundreds of them this time. Hundreds of them, masked, jackbooted thugs, just marching past. And, you know, the scariest part was when people were asking, who are you? What do you stand for? Silence. Just this stone-cold silence as they march past with their upside-down flags and Reclaim America sign. That was the only words that were visible. You know, it's terrifying. It's terrifying to see this. And when you realize that they have the backing of one of the major political parties in this country, one of two, this could be our future if we don't do something about it. You know, if we can either fight them now or we can fight them later when they have all the power. It's our choice. But hiding under the sand, that's not gonna work out. You know, it's unpleasant, and we have to confront that. We have to tell people about that. There's an article in the Associated Press that came over earlier. And I saw this in the Washington Post, actually. If Roe versus Wade falls, some fear ripple effect on civil rights cases. Yeah, did you think about that? If the Supreme Court decides to overturn or gut the decision that legalized abortion, some fear it could undermine other precedent-setting cases, including civil rights and LGBTQ protections. Why not? Why wouldn't it? Of course it would. It's the same mentality. It's the same philosophy. Overturning Roe versus Wade would have a bigger effect than most cases because it was reaffirmed by a second decision, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 3 decades later. The Supreme Court's conservative majority signaled in arguments last week they would allow states to ban abortion much earlier in pregnancy and may even overturn the nationwide right that has existed for nearly 50 years. A decision is expected next summer. Now, if a case like Roe, which has this double precedent value, is overturned simply because there's a change in the composition of the court, there's really no way we can have confidence in any of these precedents going forward. That's according to Samuel Spittal, who is the director of litigation at the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. So, this is scary. We are in scary times, but doesn't mean it's inevitable. It is if we're quiet. It is if we don't speak up and say something. And unfortunately, most people don't speak up, don't say anything. That's why your voice matters so much more, because there are so many people who are silent. So every voice that's raised will be heard by many more.
And we're listening. We're always listening. You can write us, OTW at 2600.com. And we're always honored to have the opportunity to speak to you here at WUSB Stony Brook, the most dangerous station in the nation.
And, you know, we're still in our radiothon. We wouldn't have had the chance to say this during the basketball game, but since we're on, yes, you can call in and pledge and join the people who have already pledged during Off the Wall. I think we're over $500 for this show, which is great. It's higher than it usually is. All you have to do is call 631-632-WUSB, 631-632-9872. If you get voicemail, leave your name and phone number. Somebody will get back to you and offer you all kinds of things in exchange for however much you want to pledge. You can also go to WUSB.fm and follow the pledge link. And I believe you can do the whole thing online. And every amount, whether it's a monthly recurring donation or whether it's a one-time donation, it all adds up. It all makes things possible. You know, a piece of equipment falls apart, we can fix it because we have the funds to fix it.
We can count on you.
Yes, yes. And we know that, you know, you're out there. It really is kind of, you know, like we're just checking to see if anyone's still there. And we found that, yes, in fact, there are a lot of people out there.
Whether you're listening on WUSB.FM over the internet or on the FM airwaves on all of Long Island.
Yeah, on either 107.3 or 90.1, two frequencies. So pick your whichever one you're closest to, I guess. But, yeah, we were driving around the island, and east and west, we were hearing USB pretty well.
It's been going far these days.
I was happy with it.
We're happier than normal.
And when you're out of the range, you can there's all sorts of apps now that allow you to tune in, and listen to it over the same speakers as if you were local.
Yeah, if you live with a robot, there are chances that robot will find our radio signal over the internet. Of course, most robots are connected. Some aren't.
You just scared the hell out of me because I'm thinking now of conservative robots trying to find our radio station and obliterate it. I can see that in the future, but it doesn't have to be that way.
I think our robots are better, but that's different. That's different. That's not really what I was getting at. You can summon our station.
Now I'm picturing some kind of demonic middle-of-the-night witchcraft thing.
Just like an antenna breaking out of the earth and the bright light of signal.
Whatever you need to do to get us, yeah. Just please listen. It matters.
Okay, without the summoning all the machines, just that specific one that's helping you, you can say whatever the word is, play WUSB.
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly.
It's not hard.
If you have an Alexa device, I have to say it quietly because if I say it loudly, she'll wake up. You can just say, play WUSB. Usually that works. Usually that's enough. You don't have to say how to play it, or it'll usually figure it out, and you'll be listening to WUSB before you know it.
And if you want to listen to the latest version of this particular program, you can say, whatever the word is, play the off-the-wall radio show.
I think you can just say play off-the-wall.
I think
you can do that.
Or you can say radio show. I think either
it might play the Michael Jackson song. You know what? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what it's going to do.
Try off-the-wall radio show if you get a sample of Michael Jackson somehow.
And what happens, though, it remembers. It remembers where you were. So if you stop listening and then you say it again in the future, it's going to pick up where you left off. So you have to listen to the whole show. That's the condition.
It's a lot. It's a lot to keep up with, and just like these news stories, I mean, you're talking about the Supreme Court. There's so much going on just with the judiciary in our government, to say nothing of the governments around the world and universe. So I'll just let you keep going.
I've got some exciting news here that nobody seems to know about. You know, I've been asking around. This is true, and nobody can confirm it. You know, we have a representative here.
Out with it.
I'm trying to be out with it. We have a representative here on Long Island that's who's not very nice. He's a right-wing white supremacist. Boy, that's hard to say. Who has ruled with an iron fist and a closed mind for a number of years now. Of course, I'm talking about Representative Lee Zeldin, who is somehow reelected every 2 years. In Suffolk County, well, not somehow. Suffolk County is extremely racist and right wing. Well, not extremely, but enough. You know, when we traveled cross country recently, I came to the conclusion that Suffolk County is more fervently right wing than the Midwest and some of the really red states. They're a lot more polite, a lot more laid back. You know, but here you got the pickup trucks coming up behind you and people getting very angry at nothing and all the flags and banners and horn honking and intimidation. You don't have that out there. Well, if you do, you know, it's not as obvious as it is here.
Well, yeah, there's not as much defensiveness about it and, like, something to prove or be so outwardly aggressive and
okay.
I mean, just because they don't think that there are that many others that
you know what though that's a good thing. Yeah, maybe the defensiveness is a sign that we're getting to them, that they know that their days are numbered. Maybe that's why they feel they have to intimidate. Okay, yeah, you see, you just made me feel good about intimidation and about all these idiots out there that are trying to drown out everybody else.
It's not that their days are numbered. The days of the attitude, some of the attitudes they're wielding are a bit dated.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, their days as right-wing rednecks that intimidate everybody else, those days are numbered. They may go on to become very wise and pleasant people to be around. I hope so. I look forward to that. Anyway, so we have our Representative Lee Zeldin, who has caused all kinds of problems, tried to overthrow the election, is pro-virus, and you take anything, infrastructure bad, he votes down infrastructure, anything that is good, putting out a fire in an orphanage, he'll vote against it. Whatever you think is the right thing to do, he'll do the opposite and somehow keep getting reelected. Anyway, as you may know, and I don't know how you wouldn't know this because he won't shut up about it, he's running for governor next year. He's been talking about it since last year. But he's running for governor against how many Cuomos are there? Chris Cuomo, he was in the news too. Andrew Cuomo, yeah, that's the one. He's still running against Andrew Cuomo. I know, Andrew Cuomo's no longer the governor, but Lee Zeldin is still running against him. Because he doesn't know enough about Kathy Hochul, so he can't really attack her. So he keeps attacking Andrew Cuomo, thinking that the rest of us aren't paying attention. He doesn't have a chance in hell of beating anybody for this post. But this story that I found in Newsday a couple of days ago has this interesting paragraph in it that's either completely wrong or totally right. Zeldin's declaration that he is seeking the Republican, the Republican and Conservative Party nominations for governor and will forego his House seat after serving four terms does little to change. Okay, that's why I stopped reading. Because what that sentence says is that by running for governor, not winning, not losing, just by running, he will forego his House seat after serving four terms. This came after a Democratic congressman also decided he wanted to run for governor of New York, and he made it very clear that he was going to give up his seat. Apparently, according to this Newsday article, Zeldin is doing the same thing. Is this true? Have we gotten rid of Zeldin? That's what I want to know. I've been asking everybody for the last week or so, is this true? And nobody seems to know the answer. I cannot find a statement by Zeldin that says he's giving up his seat. But imagine if that were so.
It's like his...
Oh, my God.
His ambition... is like eliminating him from that position by virtue of his seeking another office.
Well, no, I think he can run for both. He just looks kind of silly doing it. But
yeah, that was like the whole campaigning while in office.
I don't know how many seats you can run for at the same time, but if this is true, and I stress if this is true, then by this time next year, we will not have Zeldin in any elected office. Think about that world. Think about that world, listeners. I'm sorry, I got this big goofy smile on my face. I didn't think this was something that was a foregone conclusion.
Snap out of it.
I'm trying.
We
have other things. More good news and proof that things can move forward. In Suffolk County, which is the county we're in, the legislature threw its support today behind a plan to work with the town of Islip on a $2.3 billion Ronkonkoma redevelopment project that includes a convention center, health science center, and a northern terminal at Long Island MacArthur Airport. Lawmakers voted 17-0, with one abstention, to approve an intermunicipal agreement with Islip to build the 3.1 million square foot Midway Crossing complex, which would connect the new airport terminal to the Ronkonkoma LIRR station. So think about what that means. That means you now have an airport terminal connected directly to a train station that connects directly to Manhattan. It becomes the most convenient way to fly into Manhattan. Because, if you go to JFK, you've got to take the air train, LaGuardia. It's anyone's guess how you're going to get to the city from there. But this makes it so simple. And that's a good thing. That is a really good thing. So, of course, it's going to take 15 years to complete it, but unanimous with one abstention, so that's good.
Well, and maybe parts of it will be completed during various milestones within that greater time period for the whole project. But those things matter, and it adds choice, different options, and maybe alleviates the capacity in other places. Allows for more of the individuals that are in closer proximity to other transport hubs to make better use of what's nearby for them. So, great to hear.
Let me just reach over here. There we go. And here we are. It's, again, time for Films of the Year That Was. The feature where Kyle and I take a trip down memory lane and see a film that has won the Academy Award. We've been doing this since 1929, or we've been watching films that came out in 1929, and even films before then that didn't win anything because there were no Academy Awards then. But we've seen every one from 1929 up until, what are we at, 2008 now? So review the two films, because there's two films, the domestic film and the international film. Which one shall we talk about first?
That's right. Yeah, we've been seeing them.
You didn't answer me.
Die Falscher.
Okay, that still doesn't answer me. That just sounds kind of scary.
The foreign film.
The international film, which sounds German.
Austrian-German, and it's a drama film.
Would you maybe tell us the English translation of that?
The Counterfeiters.
The Counterfeiters, of course, yes. I saw that. I saw it last week. And it was about a guy who was very good at counterfeiting money. But there's more to the story than just that.
Oh, is there? He starts out with him sort of washing ashore and slipping into society in a town.
But then there's a flashback.
It's Monte Carlo, yes. He arrives. And he gets you get to know who and how he came to be there, as it does. It goes back to 1936, and you see the skill of this person existing in the city of Berlin as a professional or pseudo professional typographer, but really does forgery. As his primary, faking currency and official documents like passports. He is brought into custody, imprisoned in a labor camp.
Did you mention the time period this was happening in?
Right. Ultimately, end up in a concentration camp because after 1936, yes, this is Nazi Germany. So, he secures protection by bringing attention to his ability to fake documents, and they end up forming an entire department in the camp.
Apparently, this is based on a true story, and he was a counterfeiter, also a Jew, and that got him into a concentration camp pretty quickly. But because of his skills and those skills of other similar people who were brought together, the German military force had this program where they were attempting to counterfeit both UK pounds, British pounds, and American dollars to fund their war effort, and also to try and destroy the economies of England and the United States by basically spreading all this counterfeit money within the economy.
And they also feel like the fact that they're having to go to these lengths perhaps an indicator of the demoralized state, or that they may not have reason to have as much confidence, I guess, in the German efforts therein at that point. But it also is remarkable. It is their self-preservation instincts, the ability they have, keeps them in relative comfort compared to other parts of this particular facility. And it's just a really gripping black and white film.
Wait, was it in black and white? You know, I don't remember. It was so gripping, I don't remember if it was in black and white or color. I think it was in color.
Hold on, I'm looking.
Yeah, I think that would have stuck in my mind if it was in.
Now, you know what? I might be getting that part wrong.
We just assume the Nazis are in black and white because, you know, the footage is like that. But it was a compelling story. It was definitely something that kept you on the edge of your seat. A story, yet another story about Nazi Germany, about concentration camps that you didn't know about. And basically, the brutality is certainly not shied away from in any sense. there's kind of like there's some humor in it in the horror. The fact that this guy has been trying to counterfeit American dollars, and it took basically a horrible situation for him to finally cross that last goalpost and succeed in doing it, trying to save others' lives. He was able to make this counterfeit money, and in the end, spoiler alert, it's kind of what guarantees his future. The fact that he can lose all this money in Monte Carlo and just say to the person he's with, well, you can always make more money. I thought that was kind of cute.
Right. Those were leftover stuff that had he was able to recover, I think, after he was fleeing the camp. Those bills didn't really matter. he realized what they were.
Yeah, it was almost like he was trying to lose them.
Yeah, he was letting it go after a certain point and kind of laughing it off, given what he had been through. So there's a lot of beauty in this, and a real tragic serious historic reference based on a book, as we said. And
that was a real moral quandary too. Like, do you continue to help the Nazis to save yourself? Because that's what at least one of the people he was imprisoned with was saying to him, and his response was, what would our deaths accomplish? How, you know, standing up for a principle, what is a it's a valid question, and one that we could debate for hours, and it was something that many people struggled with.
Yeah, absolutely. Moments like that. There was sabotage even at various points in the production process, mm-hmm. and because of disputes among the people that were in this particular specialized section. And, the contrast, because, like, when things ended at this location, they almost were attacked by other members of the camp, because it was unrecognizable how well off they had it in comparison, doing this work, and like sort of the wall crumbles and falls down, and as they're freed, they're sort of realizing the conditions other prisoners were in. Really, just it's a powerful images. I can see why this was award-winning in that year.
2007. If I said 2008 before, I mean 2007.
Yeah, we're still in 07. I could have said that as well. And I'm sorry about the reference to black and white. I don't think it was.
Well, it could have been. And your mind is in black and white, and I think that's a powerful statement in and of itself.
I'm maybe thinking some of the flashbacks were, but now I'm embarrassed to say. So let's move on. We'll correct ourselves.
That's The Counterfeiters, highly recommended. And, okay, so the domestic film, which we just saw, was?
No Country for Old Men.
You know, I always saw that title go by. It comes from a Yeats poem, I believe. And I never actually saw the film. And I gotta say, it's a polar opposite from that mess, that hot mess last week of The Departed. The Departed was a good film, but it was confusing. It was confused. I think it was very flawed. No Country for Old Men, very complex as well. But, boy, they told the story well. They really had you. They really had, and every aspect of it was beautifully filmed. The dialogue was spot on, and you know, I couldn't find anything wrong. I mean, I hated all the violence, obviously, but, like, for instance, not to compare it to The Departed too much, but they had that scene that really bugged me, where somebody makes returns a call from a restricted number somehow. You know, I've seen all kinds of excuses for how that's possible. It's not possible. You can't do it. If somebody blocks their number, you can't just call them back. Unless they tell you what their number is. But in this particular case, you know, you use little attention to details. For instance, when the character, main character is in a motel, or no, I guess it's a hotel because there's hallways inside it, and he's calling down to the front desk and, you know, to see if the guy is there to warn him about somebody who might be after him checking in. And first of all, there's the drama of the phone just ringing without an answer, and you know what that means. But you hear the phone ringing in the receiver. You also hear, way in the distance, the analog bell of a phone ringing. And it's just off by a little bit, but that is exactly how it works. That's what it would sound like.
Well, it also reiterates or like emphasizes so well that space and how small it might be or how thin the walls are, and gives you the a really good spatial glimpse of what this hotel is like.
Uh-huh.
And he's just up the stairs, so of course he can hear it, you know, with all the wood interior, and it's true. I find the word that came to mind is intricate, and the imagery, and yes, some of the technology. It's a little bit earlier than that other film, so it's not a lot of like software and displays that can get things so wrong. And
it took place in 1980, but it was filmed in 2007.
No, yeah, that's the kind of tech is from the 80s, mm-hmm. of course. So it's simpler and less screens and things like what you were talking about, the caller ID display. Not as important because they're not showing. But the technical things they got throughout are so correct and like you said, hard to find a single flaw with what they're conveying, and it is graphic, as more gory than perhaps most people would enjoy.
The other thing I really liked was that it didn't follow formula. You know, it's in many films you have a protagonist and an antagonist, and you know, it's all building up to this inevitable confrontation between them and this you know, climactic fight. That didn't happen. You had the characters, certainly could have happened, but that would have been like every other film. This was a psychological thriller where, you know, you were one step ahead, or maybe you were one step behind. Maybe somebody's outsmarting you, or maybe you got lucky and outsmarted them somehow. You didn't know what was going to happen next. Characters that you figured would be triumphant suddenly get killed. You know, it's amazing. It really is. The people that should be spared aren't. People that shouldn't be spared are. That is what creative filmmaking is. That's based on a book, but directed by the Coen brothers. And I think having that, you know, these are the people that brought us Fargo. It's a guarantee of something truly amazing and cinematographically, I would say, close to perfection.
Yeah, yeah. The same themes from several of their projects before, including Fargo in 1996, were contributing in areas they explore in this.
But I like to go into these things ignorant. I didn't know it was the Coen brothers. I recognized as the film was playing out.
Oh, we were thinking that
immediately. This looks like Fargo. This is a lot like Fargo. Just the way it was shot, and of course it was the Coen brothers, but I, you know, oftentimes I just don't pay attention to things, and I knew the title of the film, but I never actually looked into it.
Yeah, it was that interplay of showing characters, and also really unique characters. I'm thinking, like, local talent, people from the area, and there were so many people where just a look or a glance in their face, just you got their whole persona and how they
that,
were.
That woman who refused to give the bad guy the location of the good guy's workplace, she was perfect. I can't describe her better than
trailer
that.
Park manager or
trailer park manager,
something like
yeah.
That. Yeah,
I mean, I believe she is a trailer park manager. Maybe she is. I don't know, but boy. She should win an Oscar for that portrayal, unless that's who she is, in which case you shouldn't win an Oscar for being yourself, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know if we went into too much about the plot, but there's a drug deal gone wrong, there's missing money.
It sounds boring when you say it, though.
There's
you know, drug
bag,
deal gone, bad money,
bag
drugs.
Of cash with a transponder.
That dog, though. Oh, my God, the dog that chased the, what's his name, Lou Ellen?
Lou Ellen, yeah.
Who's that a guy's name, Lou Ellen? Okay, whatever. I'm going to skip over that.
Don't question it.
But Lou Ellen is his name, and he's running from these people that are chasing him, and a dog. And this dog, boy, this is the dog of nightmares, because he is intent on catching this guy and really hurting him or killing him. He jumps into a river, swims across the river. The dog jumps in after him and is swimming, and they get to the other side, and the dog is right there. I mean, this dog really knows what to do. This is... I've never seen a dog with such purpose. So I think I had a nightmare last night about that.
Absolutely. And ultimately, you are introduced to Anton Sugar, who is...
not sweet. Not,
after
not,
the money.
Not
yes.
Sweet like sugar.
Yeah, and that is the rest of the film is seeing him and in and out of various groups of people and the interplay of all those groups of people.
There were a lot of people killed in this film, but a lot of the killing took place off camera. And that made it more powerful somehow because you realize, oh my God, he did it. He actually killed this person.
Yeah. There are plenty of on-camera bits of gore and so forth, but that is almost a throwback to production code stuff where you're not really doing it any more justice by showing that much more. It's still eerie and it moves the story and shows a different visual, but conveys the same thing.
Yeah, but contrary to code, it's not done because of a regulation. It's done because it's artistic to do it this way.
Right, right. Whereas then, during that era, those things, of course, would be the only way to share that.
This film could never pass production code because the good guy doesn't win. I'm sorry, spoiler. Good guy doesn't win.
Yeah, you're right, you're right.
And, it also kind of ended in a place you didn't expect it to end.
Well, and that too, just the place where someone who was tasked with fixing or finding restitution in a community, coming to grips, helping people come to grips with real tragedy and the horrors of, the worst in that police officer, just finding that maybe he just couldn't do it or it wasn't, it had evolved, it had become something he just wasn't at all equipped to face anymore.
That's also something you see in Fargo and other Coen Brothers films. Just this senior law enforcement guy is kind of in over his head, but, conveys stability and honor and honesty. In this case, though, just complete bewilderment. What motivates these people? What kind of horrors are unleashed?
But by not having a conclusion is like he's aware of his own limitations or something about that is so sincere.
So No Country for Old Men, highly recommended. And that is going to conclude things for this week. And it's going to conclude the show, too, because look at us. We're out of time already. Boy, that 50 minutes went by fast. It was a full show. Next week, though, I promise we're 15 minutes because, well, hopefully we're 15 minutes. Hopefully there won't be another COVID outbreak and we'll have an actual basketball game at 6:15. But you can write to us, otw@2600.com. That is our email address. Feel free to say whatever is on your mind, whether you agree with us or disagree with us. The important thing is that you speak out and say something to somebody and don't let things pass you by, and don't ignore what's in front of you or behind you. All right. I guess we will call it a night until next week.
Look out for yourselves. Look out for one another. And until next time.
Good night.
Train.